The new movie Love, Simon does something that many teenage dramas do not. It shows the experiences of a young man struggling with his sexual identity, and he's not a friend of the protagonist, he is the protagonist. In this clip from the film, the lead character Simon talks with his father about his decision to come out as gay.
How long have you known?
I was around 13.
4 years. 4 years of eating dinner together. 4 years of going to movies together. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have missed it.
Hey, no, Ted.
All the stupid jokes.
I know you didn't mean them.
I just want you to know that I love you.
Okay, I'm crying now. Love, Simon is in theaters, and it was filmed in Georgia, and it's based on the novel Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by the Atlanta-based author Becky Albertalli, who joins us right now. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning.
Also with us by Skype is actor Clark Moore, who is from Atlanta and appears in this film as Ethan, an openly gay classmate of Simon's. Good morning, Clark.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Becky, what's the premise of the story?
I really think of it as a love story, first and foremost. But it's about a boy named Simon who's in high school, and he's gay, but he is only out to his secret online pen pal. So they don't know each other's actual identities. They just know that they go to the same school, and they kind of develop this email correspondence with each other. And gradually, I think they kind of, through that conversation and that friendship that they form, they become more and more comfortable with the idea of coming out to friends and family kind of in real life. And then it's sort of all building towards, this moment of like, who is this guy that Simon has been talking to, and what will happen if they meet in person?
And along the way, Simon does a lot of introspection about his identity. Let's listen to a clip. We hear Simon posing the question about straight being the default sexual orientation. Let's listen.
I've been thinking about why I haven't come out yet. Maybe it's because it doesn't seem fair that only gay people have to come out. Why is straight the default?
So, Becky, being who you are, which is not a young gay male teen, what made you want to write from that perspective?
I think it's a complicated question. And the first thing that I always kind of want to preface this with is when I wrote the book in 2013, I didn't think it would ever be published as a book, much less kind of, become a movie and become, a relatively well-known book that, kind of is a big part of this conversation now. And so, if I were making this decision today in 2018, I don't know that I would have written this particular book, this coming out story. That might...
Why not?
I think, there's been a lot of conversation within the book community over the last couple of years, and I've been listening to that pretty carefully, and I take it very seriously. And it's, there's just a lot of wisdom being shared about who has a right to tell what story, like ownership of stories. I think it is really important, particularly moving forward, and hopefully... one of my main goals sort of with the platform that I have from Simon is try to pass the mic to people who are speaking with the experience of having lived through something that like what Simon lived through or somebody who has a totally different coming out experience, mm-hmm. because there are so many different experiences.
Well, we have the opportunity to literally pass the mic now to Clark Moore, who's an actor in the film and did grow up as a gay male teen in high school. What about this story resonates with you, Clark?
Yeah, I think it's the story that I experienced growing up as well. I think what we see from Simon is that no matter who is around you, your family, your supportive community, it's still one of the hardest things that we as LGBT people have to do, is sort of shatter the expectations the world had for us and tell you, I'm completely different to what you expected. So that's what resonated with me. It spoke to my experience, and it spoke to the experiences of a lot of my friends.
This movie is being talked about as the first gay teen rom-com. Clark, how do you think it would have affected things for you if you had had the book and the movie available to you when you were in high school?
We talk about that a lot. That's sort of the first thing that I thought about when I watched the movie in a screening with my mother back in September, was how much it would have helped both her and me to sort of go through this awkward situation. You know, I was so loved by my parents, and I had a very fortunate upbringing. That is not the case for everyone who comes out, which is important to note. But even still, it was really difficult and it was really awkward. I think just the fact that people can now see themselves on screen and see their stories, I think that's really profound, and that's how it would have affected me.
The mother in this film, Simon's mother, is played by Jennifer Garner, who has gotten a lot of praise for her role as a parent in the movie and her how she plays a parent embracing her gay teenage son. Let's listen to a clip.
You get to exhale now, Simon. You get to be more you than you have been in a very long time. You deserve everything you want.
Becky Albertalli, the author who wrote the book that Love, Simon is based on, is with us. And Becky, I suppose, you know, if you had written this book a generation ago, the chief source of conflict in the story would have been how Simon would not be accepted by his family, how everyone would be mean to him and reject him. And you're writing this in a very different time, where everyone is, well, at least everyone, a lot of people are very, very supportive of him, and it's all very, very sweet. So you have to find other sources of conflict. Is that a challenge?
Yeah. Well, one thing I definitely want to say is, you know, Simon's story, you know, he is a very modern teen, and he does have the good fortune, kind of like Clark was saying, where, you know, his parents are very loving, and you know, there are some growing pains, I think, with you know, that relationship and the conversations they have around his coming out. But ultimately, they're very, very supportive. But that is not the case universally for kids even now. And I think, you know, generally, you know, generationally, there's a trend towards you know, greater support and kind of, you know, overall. You know, maybe culturally we're more progressive than we were, you know, those decades ago, but that doesn't mean that we are where we need to be. And certainly there are many, many teens who are, you know, are not coming out to quite as supportive of a family unit and friend group as Simon is. But yeah, I think... you know, so for me, writing this this book, I never considered, you know, having the conflict be, you know, the reaction from Simon's, like, family or friends to his coming out experience, because that just, you know, in, you know, my mind as I'm telling Simon's story, you know, I'm telling his particular story, and this is sort of the environment that he's living in, but it's very specific to him and not kind of a stand-in for all, like, teens in 2018.
Yeah, we're talking about the new movie Love, Simon, adapted from the book Simon Versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda. The author of that book, Becky Albertalli, is with us. Also with us is an actor from the film, Clark Moore. Clark, the film has gotten tremendously good reviews. I have noticed some online commenters, some negative Nancys out there who are saying things along the lines of, "Why? Come on, guys, why do we, it's the year 2018, why do we need another film about a gay teen, as though that's some barrier-breaking thing? It's just part of life now." What would you say to those critics?
Yeah, I think that these stories open the door for more stories. The fact that Simon has been so well received is what's going to give us the opportunity to tell stories that are maybe seem a little bit more fringe to the people who aren't within the LGBT community, but are maybe a little bit closer to center for us. And that the film is really good. You know, that's the other thing that watching it, I'm a huge fan of the movie. And you don't always get to say that when you do a project. So I say go see it. And then, you know, if you don't like it, that's okay. But I do think it's making some really great strides in gay cinema.
That's great. Becky, is there going to be a sequel?
To the film? I don't know. That's sort of up to Fox Studios and people who are way more embedded in Hollywood than I am. There is
indeed, but a new book would be a good place to start.
Yes. there is a sequel. There's a book coming from the point of view of Simon's friend Leah called Leah on the Offbeat that's coming out in a little less than a month, April 24th. And so this is sort of, I guess, a different spin on some of the events of Simon's story.
Okay. That's Becky Albertalli, author of Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda, that novel adapted into the new movie Love, Simon, which stars, among others, actor Clark Moore, who was also with us just then. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Georgia's state legislative session adjourned for the year early this morning. As always, state lawmakers scrambled to vote on as many bills as possible before the clock struck midnight. And now that the dust has settled, we want to get some details on what is making it to Governor Nathan Deal's desk for him to sign or not, as the case may be, and find out really what's likely to become law here in Georgia. With us to help is Lisa Raham, who covers the state capitol for GPB-TV. Good morning to you. I bet you're tired.
I am tired, but I liked your terminology when you said the dust is settling, and that is so true. It was quite a day yesterday, and the dust has settled, and here we are the day after.
The last day of the legislative session is called sine die, which I gather is Latin for pass as many bills as possible at the last second so that people can't scrutinize what you're doing. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and to finally exhale. And that they did shortly after midnight. But yeah, it was a scramble. And, you know, it's tradition. The mood is always a happy one, even though, you know, lawmakers are frantically trying to get those all-important bills like transit through the legislative session. So,
take us through the big items. What did they actually get through?
Well, you know, yesterday the chitter chatter began about noon regarding transit. Transit has been a big topic this whole session. There were two separate bills, one in the Senate, one in the House, both very, very similar. And there was a tone struck on both sides that they wanted to reach a compromise. Well, as of noon yesterday, we still did not hear of any compromise happening. And, you know, the clock was ticking away. Around 7:30 in the evening, word leaked out that there was a compromise with the transit bill. And then finally it hit the floor in both chambers around 9, 10 o'clock last night and eventually passed. So the hype yesterday was certainly around transit, although some other important bills made their way through. One in particular dealt with sexual assault, protecting the victims. That made it through. But again, transit dominated everything yesterday.
Okay, what specifically are we talking about? And remember that you've got a statewide audience here. This is mostly about Atlanta transit, right?
This is a regional transit plan, yes, that affects 13 counties. A lot of money set aside to create a regional authority called the ATL to what they call produce a plan that was congruent to all the counties and made sense in Georgia that accommodated the growth here in Georgia. So it's something that they've been talking about for years and years. Representative Tanner, it was his heart, it was his baby. He's been applauded by senators, lawmakers, and citizens alike for coming up with this regional transit plan. So it is a big, big, big deal for the state of Georgia.
All right. We got a call from listener Gretchen Waters of Athens wanting to know what is the status of the so-called distracted driving bill, a bill that would make people put down their phones in their cars. This is HB 673. Let's take a listen to Gretchen's comment on the phone.
I'm curious to know what the likelihood of the hands-free phone only use while driving law being signed and actually becoming law is. In November, I was riding my bicycle and hit by a texter, and now I'm facing what's going to be probably many years of recovery from shattered legs. And if it doesn't pass at the state level, I hope that the Athens, Clark County City Council and Mayor will put a local ordinance in place. We have a lot of college students here and just general people, you know, that just can't seem to figure out that they could very easily kill themselves or others because they aren't actually driving their cars while it's moving forward. Thanks.
Well, Adam, good news for the caller there. The distracted driving bill did pass both chambers, and Governor Deal will likely sign it. Governor Deal signed off on it a long time ago. You know, they had several committee hearings where they brought in victims who had children who lost their lives because a driver was texting. One in particular, I don't know if you remember, the nurses from Georgia Southern who were killed last year.
Students, yeah.
On 16. And apparently the tractor-trailer driver was looking down at his phone and didn't realize that he hit the car full of nurses. So there was some powerful, powerful testimony this legislative session, and Governor Deal signed off on it early. So it did pass yesterday, and it is very, very likely that Governor Deal will sign it.
So what specifically does it say? No touching your phone while the car is moving?
You can answer your phone, you can hang up your phone, and basically, that's about it. You can't, you know, a lot of people try to take pictures and you know, they try to text while they're driving. Everything has to be hands-free. You have to have that device where you have to sit your phone and have that hands-free device in your car. Also, if you are talking on the phone, you have to be using Bluetooth or a speaker phone. So it limits you greatly, and the penalties are in place as well.
All right. This is Governor Deal's last legislative session. He's term limited out at the end of this year. So any highlights for him? Any big vetoes he's planning to do? Anything he's going to kill?
No, it's been very, very quiet. You know, early on, his baby this session was the adoption bill. And he started off the session saying, we need to get this adoption bill done. Last session, it was derailed because there were a few elements that people didn't like involving same-sex partners adopting children, something that Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle was in favor of, and it caused a lot of controversy there. With that element taken out, he really, really put a stamp on the adoption bill and wanted to get that passed, and that passed early on. So that was a big kudo for him. That's something he wanted to see, Georgia families being able to adopt children here in Georgia as opposed to going out of state because the laws here were so antiquated and had not been updated in many, many years. So he wanted to make sure that was taken care of so that Georgia families could adopt here, right here in Georgia, and not have to go out and do that. So that was a big baby for him, and that passed as he really signed off on regional transit, a regional transit plan early on. So he was really happy about that.
GPB Capitol correspondent Lisa Raham telling us what happened in the final hours of the Georgia legislative session last night. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Well, thank you, Adam. Have a wonderful day.
Well, it's been a long week. We talked about the ransomware attack on Atlanta. We went behind the scenes of the superhero TV show Black Lightning, and we looked at the future of public transit in Georgia. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for The Break Room.
Everyone is just so nice until they drive you to kill yourself. And sooner or later, the truth will come out.
Was it hush money to stay silent?
Yes. The story was coming out again. I was concerned for my family and their safety.
Little black girls who have to know that R. Kelly is before me. If we have a Me Too movement, the Mute R. Kelly movement is going to hold everyone accountable.
Joining us in the break room to talk about those stories and more are author Nikki Salcedo. Good morning, Nikki.
Good morning.
Greg Williams, host of the radio show Greg's List, is back. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Adam. How are you?
Doing all right. LGBT educator and activist Robbie Medwed. Good morning.
Good morning.
And with me in GPB's Macon studio is a colleague of mine on the Mercer University faculty, English professor and noted poet Anya Silver. Good morning, Anya.
Good morning, Adam.
Welcome, everybody. Let's start first up in Atlanta. Atlanta City Councilman Dustin Hillis wants city residents to use an app to report blighted properties with code violations. Then Hillis wants nonprofits to acquire those properties and turn them into affordable housing. The app sends notifications when new code enforcement violations are submitted. This is going to resonate with people across Georgia, not just Atlanta. Certainly in Macon, we have a big problem with blight, vacant abandoned houses or nearly abandoned houses and commercial properties. But will an app such as this fix it? Any of the Atlanta people have an opinion?
So I would love to see this actually happen. I think it's a great, great idea. I'm really concerned about the idea of an app, though. If Atlanta can't keep their Wi-Fi safe right now, I'm not sure how they're going to be able to keep an app safe. And then all of a sudden, where are these notifications going? Who's taking a look at them? And who's going to get into all that data?
Also, identifying the blighted property is kind of the easy part, right? It's like acquiring it and coming up with the money to knock it down and all of that stuff, right, Robbie?
Absolutely. And I'd really want to know, you know, if the city's going to put this on, can I also report blighted sidewalks and streets with all the potholes and all that stuff?
Right.
Yeah. Greg, what do you make of this?
Well, yeah, I've been in the real estate business for 15 years, so I know, you know, a little bit about the seizure of properties. I think there's going to be a lot of difficulty to legally go through this to track down the owners of it. The going through the code enforcement route, typically you're going to be trying to give excessive fines to the people, sign them court dates when they don't show up in court. That'll be the mechanism that they use. Also, blight is somewhat subjective, right? So you look at a city like Avondale Estates where they have a pretty strict code there. You can't paint your house polka dot, or there's a lot of rules about that. Atlanta, you know, I think it's still kind of a little bit like the Wild West where, you know, you can have streets in Midtown that aren't governed by any kind of HOA or anything. And somebody that doesn't cut their grass, if they've had an illness or something like that, I don't think they should necessarily be subjected to a $1,000 fine and a court date if there's some kind of medical emergency or some other issue that's prevented them from doing the maintenance on their property. So I think it's a little too subjective for the average citizen to be just, you know, sending in complaints via an app.
Nikki?
I agree with anything that will create efficiencies. And I think the idea of the app will create some efficiencies. I know downstream there are other things to consider, but right now a file room with pieces of paper or someone having to physically go down to, you know, note a code violation seems antiquated, and we should definitely look at technology to create some solutions for these issues.
On the other hand, Anya, when we look at using something like an app to help us combat a problem like blight that often in its worst forms affects the poorest residents of any community, are you in effect enabling really only the wealthier residents of the community?
Well, I actually agree with Nikki. We do use Click It and Fix It in Macon, and so far I haven't heard of any major problems. I think as long as there are controls in place to prevent gentrification, in other words, speculators coming up and buying houses and then flipping them over, as long as that does not occur, I think it's a good idea.
We're talking about the week's news here on Second Thought with our break room gang. Atlanta-based Delta Airlines has started using fingerprint scanners instead of boarding passes. Fingerprint scanners instead of boarding passes. Not for everybody. Right now, it's just for the Delta Sky Club members. Anya, how do you feel about using biometrics to get on a plane? Is that something you'd be comfortable with?
No, I'm very uncomfortable with that. I may be a little paranoid, but I don't really want my fingerprints in some sort of large government database. And so I would prefer to just use my good old paper boarding pass to get on.
Greg, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the old-fashioned paper passport, driver's license, and boarding pass is the way to go. Because, you know, we've seen malicious use of our data. You know, we've seen breaches with Equifax. We've seen breaches. We've seen how much data mining Facebook and Google have been doing lately. And, you know, just having a fingerprint that in a database with, you know, the major airlines, that's something that could be hacked. And, you know, what kind of nefarious damage could be done if somebody had fingerprints and your Social Security number? There's a lot
on the other hand, like Nikki, you know, we've all been behind people on the boarding line to get to the airplane, and they're like fumbling through their pocket to get their boarding pass, and they're trying to get it unwrinkled out, or they've got it on their phone, but their phone is locked, and there's a whole thing there. People aren't going to be fumbling around looking for their fingers, right? That's an advantage.
I am probably the only one who's 100% behind this. I really trust Delta. I fly nearly every week. I think Delta's very smart about these business decisions, and flying is a privilege. It's not a right. If they need my fingerprint, if they need to retinal scan me, I watch a lot of Star Trek. So I'm kind of like, why are we not, you know, sampling my DNA and sending me through the transporter beam to the other planet?
I think
we're foolish to think they are not already using our biometrics. And again, it helps with security and efficiency. They can scan my thumbs as long as they want.
Yeah, I'm trying really, really hard to get worked up about this, but I have a hard time believing that they don't already have that information from the no-fly list, from other cooperation with government agencies. Like, I feel like that stuff's already out there. I think we're past the point of no return on so many of these things that, all right, if you can make me speed up in my line waiting to get on the plane a little bit, all right, let's do it.
Let's try to sneak in one more topic. The second season of Netflix's 13 Reasons Why debuts later this year. This is a mystery show about a high school girl who commits suicide, leaving a video stating her 13 reasons why. The show's creators are going to include warning videos before each segment that deals directly with suicide, with cast and crew advising viewers to seek help if they are ever thinking about harming themselves. Here's a clip from last season with executive producer Selena Gomez.
If you need help at all, you can go to 13reasonswhy.info to find an organization in your area. You can help others by spreading it as well.
Anya, does it sound to you like they're handling this issue as responsibly as they can?
I think they definitely should include that information before the show because there is the fear of copycat suicide behavior. And I have spoken to a lot of students, college students, who feel that the show is irresponsible about presenting suicide without giving possibly depressed students specific information about how to get help.
Anybody want to take the last thought on this? We got 30 seconds.
So I'm a middle school teacher, and I got to say, I think I hear adults and parents far more concerned about the show than I ever do from any of my students. I think that we are the ones who are much more shocked by all of this stuff, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing or what it says, but it's definitely something I've noticed.
I'm Adam Ragusea. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do each Friday, talking about the week's news. My guests today are Mercer University professor Anya Silver, author Nikki Salcedo, Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List, and LGBT educator and activist Robbie Medwed. Let's talk about Cosmo. Walmart is yanking Cosmopolitan magazine from their checkout lines. The company says that this is a business decision. Could someone on the panel, while complying with FCC regulations, summarize for people what a typical cover of Cosmo might look like?
I'd love to take that one.
Thank you, Nikki.
Cosmo usually features a very beautiful woman, varying degrees of clothing, lots of makeup, sometimes suggestive poses. It is a fashion magazine. You know, this isn't literary fiction. It's for fashion, relationship, sex advice, you know, beauty tips.
Mm. And the sex advice headlines tend to be the ones that are the most, shall we say, eye-catching on the cover of Cosmo. Perhaps that's what people are objecting to. On the other hand, like 2018 seems like kind of a weird year for people to get upset about Cosmo. We've crossed this bridge before. What's going on now, Robbie? What do you think?
It sounds a little bit like either they're saying, we're going to be a little even-handed here, so if we want to participate in Me Too, we got to get rid of the suggestive stuff. Or possibly, and maybe this is the cynic in me, they got rid of certain guns. Now they're going to get rid of certain magazines that liberals like so they can please the base after they've already upset people. And I don't think they're actually equal, but I think in their minds they might say, oh, see, now we're gonna just make everybody upset. And that way we can say we're doing it equally.
Yeah, they just need to open up another store called Guns and Cosmo. I think that would solve the problem, right? It's like a subsidiary company. You know?
It would fit the male demographic. I mean, honestly, many of the people buying Cosmo are men. So
Really?
Yes. If you need advice on pleasing your lady this weekend, Cosmos, where you would find it.
I feel like a Guns and Cosmos store is pretty much the one place I would really just never need to step foot into.
I'd probably buy that magazine if it had Guns and Cosmo in it, yeah.
Okay, well, I'd like to just say that there is no way that Cosmo would be considered a feminist magazine by a lot of feminists, so I'd like to sort of push back against that idea that it's a liberal magazine. But this is a ridiculous decision. Cosmo is not pornography. It's a relic of the 1950s. It's almost quaint, and I would frankly much rather see Cosmo as I check out than political propaganda on National Enquirer, which is not being pulled from Walmart. So I see absolutely no good reason for pulling it, and I don't think it has really anything to do with the Me Too movement in any intelligent way.
All right. Go ahead, Nikki.
Oh, I definitely agree with what Anya said. And if we're going to do a morality play, then they should get rid of Mountain Dew and cigarettes in addition to the guns.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Thank you.
All right. Let's move on to something a lot more serious. No charges going to be filed against two Baton Rouge police officers in the shooting death of Alton Sterling. Sterling was a 37-year-old African-American man shot and killed in 2016. Police say that they shot Sterling because he was resisting arrest and kept reaching for a gun. The Justice Department says that evidence could not prove or disprove that Sterling was, in fact, reaching for a weapon. An investigation ruled that the shooting was justified. So what do we think? Is this the right outcome for this particular shooting incident? What do you think, Robbie?
I think this is just another in a long line of the same pattern over and over of black men being targeted by police and then an attempt to justify it afterwards. You know, it feels almost like there's a template now for how these things are supposed to go, and people are just following them without paying attention.
It may indeed be the case that all of these incidents are part of a broader phenomenon, but of course, I think we in the public, just like people in the Justice Department, need to examine every single one on its individual particulars. Greg, looking at these particulars, do you think that this was the right decision to not file charges against the cops?
You know, it's without any of us actually reviewing the evidence, and you know, I didn't see as much press on this story as I did, and I was actually overseas when this you know, this verdict or the decision came out, so I can't speak with 100% knowledge on it, but you know, just it does seem like it's. I agree with Robbie that it's looks like it's another pattern. And when you don't have any charges, you know, that's going to have a lot of frustration, especially in the African American community who feel like they're being targeted by the police.
Nikki,
I'm not surprised, which is, I guess, not an opinion, but it's just the truth of it. I'm not surprised by this decision.
I'm not surprised either. I'm way beyond shock at this point, but I would like to see some transparency, and I don't see any downsides to having had a trial. If there's nothing that the police have to hide, that would have come out, and there would have been a chance for justice if that were required, which I suspect that it probably was.
Another pretty serious topic here. At least a dozen states have responded with a wave of anger and legal actions this week after the Trump administration announced that it is adding a question to the 2020 census. The 2020 census is going to ask respondents if they are U.S. citizens. Should this question be included? Anya, what do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think it will prevent a lot of people who are undocumented from filling out the census, which means that we will not get proper information about the population. And that means that underserved areas might appear to be doing better than they really are. And I don't think that we will be able to serve the population as well without that information.
To clarify a few points of fact that I think have been widely misunderstood about this story, it has been argued by the Trump administration itself that the census has been asking this question all along. That's not quite true. They asked it on the census until about 50 years ago. In more recent years, they have asked it on the American Communities Survey, which is a survey that happens in between the every 10 years census that is used to gather supplementary data. But it's not used for the big, big, big function of the every 10-year census, which is to redraw congressional districts, because the Constitution says that congressional districts should be drawn based upon the number of people who are in it, not necessarily the number of citizens who are in it. So this does have enormous political implications. What do you make of it, Greg?
Well, I think that the people that are undocumented, they avoid the census anyway. I mean, it's I remember in the 2010 one came out, they were doing Spanish language videos. My wife is from Ecuador, so we tend to know a lot of folks in the Latin circles, and they, you know, were doing targeted ads to say, please don't be scared of the Census Bureau. But I think there's still a palpable sense of fear from that community and from anybody that's here illegally. I don't see a big problem with trying to find out how many illegals are here. And I don't know if it's that much of a deterrent from people filling out the census. I think people are already paranoid from answering the census if they're here legally. So I don't think it's going to have the unintended consequences that others fear.
Nikki, what do you make of that argument?
Well, you know, I want to know what is the point of asking the question, because it certainly seems like the areas that might have more non-citizens might be penalized. So there doesn't seem to be, you know, a rationale for, you know, having this question. We all have agreed that people who are not documented are probably not going to fill it out, or people who are going to be hesitant to fill out the census. So we're already going to question the validity of the data. So what's the purpose for asking the question is what I'd really be interested to know.
Well, Robbie, the census is a research exercise, and do research questions necessarily have to have a very clear justification? Ultimately, we're talking about gathering data, which may prove to be helpful and may not prove to be helpful. What do you think?
I think they already do have a very specific reason why they're asking questions. And if we take a step back and look at the larger issues, the Trump administration is deciding which questions are going on because they want to get very specific information. They're not including anything about special minority populations, about the LGBT community, about other communities, because they don't want that information. They want to ask questions that will give them a very specific snapshot of the information that they want to use that will help benefit them politically, professionally, probably financially, all of those things. I think the research questions already have their answers that they're looking for.
I'd just like to add that this seems to me a purely political move so that the Trump administration can claim that they are doing something about undocumented immigration. I don't think that there is a good practical reason for this question.
If you're just joining us, we are hanging out in the break room and talking about the week's news with Mercer University professor Anya Silver, whom you just heard there. Author Nikki Salcedo is with us, as is Greg Williams, host of the radio show Greg's List, and LGBT educator and activist Robbie Medwed is with us, too. Okay, let's talk about R. Kelly. I think that we've known for a long time that R&B singer R. Kelly has had some problematic sexual practices in his personal life. A recent BBC interview reveals that Kelly groomed teenage girls as his quote-unquote pets. Now people are protesting his shows. Let's listen to a clip.
My name is Nicole Denson, and I'm out here because I started the Mute R. Kelly Detroit. It's a national movement founded by Kenyette Barnes, and I'm here taking a stand for my city.
It is remarkable that R. Kelly's popularity has been so persistent in the face of these allegations, which have been around for a very, very long time. Nikki, do you think that the moment is actually changing for R. Kelly now?
I hope so. And fortunately, I am an R. Kelly expert. So I will say he has a beautiful voice, and we are really willing to ignore the bad behavior of celebrities and people with money. And if his victims were named Gwyneth Paltrow, it would get a little bit more traction. But his victims are sort of nameless women who come from less resourced communities, and he's able to prey on them. And, you know, if this is a movement, I would join. I would join the Boycott R. Kelly movement. If you listen to his lyrics, we should have been boycotting him from a long time ago.
Anya, as an English professor at Mercer, you no doubt deal with great works of art produced by horrible men all the time. Is this a similar situation?
No, this is – I won't get into the details, but – R. Kelly's behavior, as alleged, is particularly horrible, especially towards vulnerable minor girls. And being famous is not an excuse for abusing human beings. And I agree that if these women were not often women of color and women who don't have people to support them, we would be hearing about it. So mm-hmm. we absolutely need to look into this and do a real investigation and, if necessary, put him on trial for this behavior, these crimes, really.
Ultimately, that's in the hands of prosecutors, but right. Us as consumers can decide whether or not we keep listening to R. Kelly and giving him money. Robbie, are you making any decisions in that area?
I am 100% behind everything that Nikki and Anya just said, and I don't know that I could say anything better than they did.
Greg, you going to go to the R. Kelly concert?
No, and I think it's interesting to juxtapose kind of the media attitudes towards the Parkland students versus, you know, the R. Kelly victims. And I have to agree with our previous speakers and pretty much, you know, everybody on the panels agreeing that, you know, R. Kelly's behavior is reprehensible. The boycott movement should be taken off. And I'm surprised, but also not surprised that the media is ignoring it largely. But it's just interesting to see that there are the media, if they have their, you know, polished students able to talk a lot and media savvy ones, they're going to put them up all over the interview circuit. But, you know, these victims that maybe don't have the resources or the you know, media savvy, they're silenced, unfortunately.
Well, at the moment, we are the media and we're talking about it. So go us. okay. this is another very deeply serious topic. You've heard of chicken and waffles. What do you think of lobster and waffles? Red Lobster is planning to serve fried Maine lobster and waffles. The waffles will be made from the same batter that they use to make those cheesy biscuits at Lobster and Waffles. At Red Lobster, I should say. Chicken and waffles, one of the official dishes of the state of Georgia. Is lobster and waffles really that big of a stretch from what we're all accustomed to? Anya, what do you think?
Well, I'd like to know what Beyonce has to say about this in terms of her relationship. it just sounds repulsive to me, and I don't eat lobster, so I'm not really a good person to ask about that, I think.
Okay. Nikki, shellfish and, you know, fried shellfish is a thing. Shellfish and bread is a thing. Shellfish with a sweet sauce is a thing. So why can't, you know, fried lobster with waffles and maple syrup be a thing?
It can be a thing, and I basically will eat anything, but I have to say this one gives me a little moment of pause. And if you have Maine lobster, why are we ruining it? But so I'm going to be on the fence. I'll just be a maybe. If I say I'll never eat this, I'll probably be served it tomorrow, but it's unlikely that I would eat this dish.
Greg, how about you?
Yeah, I think it's a winner, and it's a perfect meal. And it's a perfect meal for Catholics on Good Friday, right?
So. Good point. Good point. Robbie, you're going to be eating the fried lobster.
Coming from the opposite side, as the Jewish guy leading up to Passover, I've never had lobster in my life. I have no idea what it tastes like. But I'm glad to live in the world, in a world where this kind of thing exists for those who want it. I don't think I'll ever try it, but I'm glad that, you know, someone's going to be made, probably Greg, very, very happy by this dish.
Yeah, and Eggo will come out with a brand later that'll probably be hideous, right?
So.
I don't know why that crossed the line for me just then, but it did.
Oh, yeah. Imagine the toaster popping those babies out.
Now we're all hungry.
All right. In our last minute, let's look ahead to the weekend. Mercer University Professor Anya Silver, what you doing this weekend?
I'm going to sleep and do laundry. So that's those are my exciting plans.
We have today off. It's Good Friday here at Mercer.
Oh, it's Easter. My goodness. I have to go out and buy some Easter candy. That's what I'll be doing.
Greg Williams, what are you getting up to this weekend?
Wow, we've got the wife's family in town. They flew in from Ecuador and drove from Miami to Atlanta. So we got a big barbecue planned tomorrow. I think they actually bought a Marshalls because every day they've come home just loaded. And we're busy unpacking that. They had a couple Sherpas helping bring it in last night. So it's been a fun weekend so far. And it's going to be even more fun going into Easter.
LGBT educator and activist Robbie Medwood, what you doing this weekend?
So it's Passover, so tonight and tomorrow night I'll be gathered around the table with family and friends to celebrate the Passover Seder, but immediately got to run home and finish all my cooking and cleaning and get everything ready.
Author Nikki Salcedo.
Easter Sunday, so I will be attending church, and my family has a very famous tradition of a water balloon Easter egg hunt. We send the kids into the backyard to hunt for eggs, and the adults go to high locations and pelt them with water balloons. It's very high.
That's amazing.
Nice, nice, nice. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend. That's it for our show today. But as listeners, we always want to hear from you. Where do you weigh in on the most controversial topic we discussed today, which, of course, is fried lobster and waffles? Let us know. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can give us a call at 404-500-9457, or you can post to our Facebook page. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.